Case number 24-5144. Linda Martin, appellant versus Federal Bureau of Investigation and Kash Patel in his official capacity as Director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Mr. Frommer for the appellant, Mr. Koppel for the appellees.
Good morning. My name is Robert Frommer for appellant Linda Martin. This case involves a challenge to the FBI's forfeiture notices. Starting with mootness, if I may, the district court correctly held that the putative class's claims were inherently transitory. But as we noted in last week's 28J, the court sequencing then got jurisdictionally tangled. It should have first granted the effectively unopposed class certification motion and only then dismiss the class claims under Rule 12b-6. Instead, it did the opposite, dismissed those claims without raising a class, and then denied the certification as moot.
Could I just be clear? If the district court jumps to the merits and says the merits are unpersuasive, what's the problem with saying, well, if I'd get granted class certification, the issue would be moot because there's no cause of action? I understand that procedurally, but I wonder in terms of substantively, how does it harm your client here?
Well, the misordering, missequencing here meant that the district court, arguably in dismissing the claims, acted without jurisdiction because Linda Martin's individual claim, everybody conceded, was moot at the time of the decision. So at that point, the only thing before the court was putative class's claims.
Well, the district court did say that the class action didn't take that as moot.
You're right, Your Honor. And the district court was correct in holding that the class claims fit under the inherently transitory exception. But once that happens, at that point, jurisdictionally, the only thing that could be before the court is the putative class's claims, which means you have to certify.
You haven't raised a single argument in this court until a 28J letter suggesting there was any error whatsoever in how the district court handled the class action certification question, and in fact, dropped a footnote affirmatively, not waiving the issue, but affirmatively telling us to leave it the district court's judgment of mootness as to class certification in place. So I don't understand why you get to now argue that the district court didn't do it right and didn't have jurisdiction.
Well,
you made an affirmative choice to ask this court to keep that part of the district court's judgment intact. So we'll take you at your word.
Well,
and then the only question is, do we have anything before us regarding Ms. Martin's allegations? And you just said everyone agrees that's moot.
Yes, Your Honor. I would say at that point, the only thing that we were conceding is that the district court correctly held that the class claims, the putative class claims, were inherently transitory.
That's not what you said. You said the government opposed class certification only is moot. If this court reverses and remands, and the only thing brief to us that we could reverse and remand on are whether Ms. Martin's claims were properly dismissed on the merits, the court, should leave the trial court's ruling on mootness undisturbed.
Yes, the inherently transitory exception.
That's it. You just said the ruling. We don't review words and opinions. We review judgments. The last words of the opinion, if that's what you want to talk about, are class action certification is moot, and the judgment is the class certification question is dismissed as moot. And so if you wish to change a judgment, which you sounds like you really want to do, you think the court lacked jurisdiction to
yes.
do that, you need to brief that issue to this court. And one, footnote's virtually never sufficient to raise a merits argument, let alone to ask for a change in the judgment. And two, it's definitely not the place to do it when your footnote says, leave the district court's ruling in place.
I understand, Your Honor.
So if that's true, then we don't have that issue before us. And you just agreed that Ms. Martin's claims are moot.
Well, Your Honor, I'd respectfully, I disagree about what we meant in that footnote. We were specifically talking about the internally transmitted.
It did not come with a decoder ring.
I understand that, Your Honor. And I would note that given this jurisdictional issue, both the Tenth Circuit in Medina and the Second Circuit in Milanes excused forfeiture. And I agree with you that we didn't raise this, but.
This is more than forfeiture. This is an express argument to leave the trial court's ruling, and this is both the end of its opinion and its judgment, on mootness, undisturbed, as to class certification. That's the opening line of the footnote.
Your Honor,
So that's more than just not thinking to say anything?
The only thing I can say, Your Honor, is by that we meant the inherently, the district court's ruling that the class claims were inherently transitory. That's the only thing we're talking about there, not the overall. I mean, at that point, if we were agreeing that both, that the court properly denied the class and dismissed the claim, we wouldn't be here.
I mean, didn't the district court here rule in your favor by saying that the class question was moot? It's in your favor because its ruling was that the claims were inherently transitory. And reading your footnote in light of what the district court wrote, I understood you to be saying that you would leave that intact.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so it wasn't an adverse ruling on whether it was inherently transitory. It was a ruling about if her individual claims are moot, the class claims are nonetheless not moot because of inherently transitory. So that was a ruling in your favor from which you are not appealing.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
I think it's not very clear in your brief.
I apologize for that, Your Honor. I would note that this goes back to the jurisdiction of the court in reaching the 12B6 without properly certifying class.
Also, are you saying now that the district court didn't have jurisdiction to do that? Because having concluded that the claims are inherently transitory, it then has before it the class claim, you know, and part of the class claim is Ms. Martin's claim as the lead plaintiff. And so it is often the case that district courts decide dispositive motions before deciding class certification motions.
I agree on it, Your Honor. The key difference here is that now let's say Ms. Martin's individual claims were alive throughout that period. Then, yes, the court could definitely have reached the 12B6 and then denied certification as moot. The issue is that everyone, the court, opposing counsel, agreed that her individual claims were moot, which means at the point that the district court said that these class claims are inherently transitory, there's no class in front of the court. There's no entity by which it can assume jurisdiction and then rule, say, oh, these class claims, oh, they do state a claim or they don't state a claim. It's until that point. That's why the Tenth Circuit in Medina, even with the forfeiture, and again, I understand, Your Honor, even with the forfeiture, recognize that this went to the court's subject matter jurisdiction and basically vacated and remanded back down.
So what remedy are you now seeking?
I think there are two.
Are you not seeking reversal of the motion to dismiss?
Well, Your Honor, I think that there's
on the merits.
I think if this court shares the Tenth Circuit and the Second Circuit's jurisdictional concerns about whether that dismissal is even jurisdictionally in front of you properly, then I think the best thing to do would be to follow the Tenth and the Second, just vacate, remand, have the court just redo everything in the correct order, the correct sequencing, and then there would be a live 12B6. Now, if the court doesn't...
You haven't asked for vacature.
What's that?
You haven't asked for that relief.
Well,
you haven't asked for that relief. You haven't asked for vacature of the district court decision. You haven't asked anywhere in your briefs for us to follow these 10th or Second Circuit cases. The other side hasn't had a chance to brief it. You've asked for reversal and you've asked,
yes,
honest to goodness, for reversal dismissing Linda's claims, not even the class claims, Linda's claims. But you agree they're moot. I don't know how on earth we should reverse decision dismissing Linda's claims, because those are definitely moot. So I don't know I'm not familiar with a practice in this court of not taking briefs at their word when they say to leave something intact, and then giving different relief than is requested in the blue brief, and sending something back based on an argument never presented anywhere in any of the appellant's briefs. I mean, you're asking for an awful lot.
I understand, Your Honor.
And we get no adversarial presentation. You're like, well, here's these other circuits that have done this thing, but we don't have adversarial briefing on whether what they've done makes sense. And we don't have adversarial briefing on how we have treated forfeiture and or waiver, let alone an affirmative argument to leave a ruling intact. It's really hard for me to know how I'm supposed to rely on those other circuit decisions when there's no adversarial briefing on it.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor, and I wish I could go back and change some of the briefing, but to make things a little bit more clear.
All of the briefing, because the brief is all about Alinda's claims.
Ms. Martin. Well, I agree that there might be some confusion about the specific language that's being used, but we were talking at that point in the briefs about the viability of a due process challenge to the notice provisions containing the FBI notices. And I would say if this court
Where do you say it should dismiss anything as to the class? Where do you argue it's a class? Because I just see the operative actor in every one of your arguments is Linda, Linda, Linda. Sorry to use her first name. I'm following your own. I would call her Ms. Martin. But your conclusion is as to dismissing Linda's claims. The sentence before that in the brief is about Linda's claims. And every turn you go, it's about Linda's claims. I mean, Linda must show up in here many, 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 many times. And I don't see you talking about the potential class claims.
Well, I understand, Your Honor. In that situation, I apologize for imprecise language, what we were talking about there, because the only thing that was before the district court at that point were the putative class claims. And that's what he dismissed. That's what
there are essentially two entities before us or before the district court. Ms. Martin's claims and the class claims.
Yes.
So it doesn't seem imprecise. It seems like a choice was made. A choice was made in the briefing to frame this all in terms of Ms. Martin's claims.
I understand that wasn't the intent, Your Honor, but I do understand. I would say that in that situation, obviously we care about this issue. Linda cares about this issue. This is an important issue. It's affecting thousands of people nationwide, and it's happening every single day. And to the extent that we didn't present the arguments in such a place where the court can rule on the merits, and then we would just ask that we be sent down because the district court.
We don't have jurisdiction. How can we do that?
Sorry, Your Honor?
We don't have any jurisdiction. Then we just dismiss the appeal. If we don't have jurisdiction over Ms. Martin's claims, do you agree?
Yes, that's correct.
We don't have jurisdiction over this whole procedural argument you want to make about what should have been done with the class because there's no class.
That's true.
I mean, that's what the cases you have cited to us say. We can't do anything. There's no class.
I understand, Your Honor. And that's why I think.
Just dismiss the appeal.
Mr. Farmer, I mean, I think you have to start with some sort of theory about what the district court did here. And the district court says that Ms. Martin's individual claims are moot. And then it has before it two, and then it says there's the inherently transitory exception to mootness applies. And so it seems at that point, the district court has two options. It can rule on the 12B6 motion, or it can certify the class and rule on the 12B6 motion. And once it's decided that the inherently transitory exception to mootness applies, why can't it go in either direction?
It can't go in.
So why do you think it can't go in either direction? Because your briefing assumes that it can go in either direction, it seems to me, which is why it addresses the merits. And so I feel like not only is the briefing confusing, but I'm not sure I understand why you are arguing what you are arguing here with respect to what the district court did, and therefore what is before us on appeal?
Before the district court, everybody agreed that Linda Martin's individual claim was moot. The court said that the class claims were inherently transitory. And the problem is at that point, because that was the only entity with live or potential entity with live claims, that that class, that legal entity needed to be raised in order to in order for the court to pass on the legal sufficiency.
But that's not true in a case where, for instance, if the district court had not found that Ms. Martin's claims were moot, it could decide either to first certify the class and then consider the merits or, you know, consider the motion to dismiss first. So why is the mootness of Ms. Martin's claims, why does it change that optionality after the district court has determined that a mootness exception applies? So that decision may be wrong, you know, or, you know, that's a separate question. But if we assume that the inherently transitory exception applies or some other exception applies, why are the same two choices not still before the district court?
Well, based on the, because Your Honor, at that point, Linda Martin's individual claims are still alive, then that would be available. But because her claims were concededly moot at that point, there was simply no legal entity under which the court could assume subject matter jurisdiction to then reach the merits of that entity's claims.
So why is it impermissible? I mean, in effect, although the district court's reasoning may not be entirely clear, it seems the district court sort of assumed that a class could be certified and then reached 12B6. So why is that? I mean, district courts do this all the time where they decide a motion to dismiss rather than go through the process of certifying a class.
I understand that, Your Honor. And I think if the end of the district court's judgment had done that, if it had gone and said, these claims are inherently transitory, I'm going to provisionally certify the class, I'm then going to dismiss the class claims that's under 12B6, and then I'm going to decertify the class or something like that, that would have been procedurally proper. But instead, what the district court did is it expressly denied the class motion certification, which means there was never a class. There was never even a provisional class.
It didn't deny class certification. It said they were moot because of the 12B6.
Well, I mean, it says it denied it as moot in light of the 12B6. But
think about judicial economy here. So we would remand under your new view for the district court to certify the class and then presumably just reach the same decision on the merits.
Yes. So,
and what would be the purpose of that?
Well, I think that at that point,
what would be gained by that?
Well, I think this court can, if this court isn't concerned about its jurisdiction, can reach the stated basis for the class, for the denial of the class certification, which was the district court's erroneous views on the merits. And I agree with you in the sense that sending something back down to get rearranged and then sent back up. I mean, the important thing here,
the reason there's a real difference, the Constitution and Article 3, because finding that claims are inherently transitory doesn't mean that there's a party before the court. And I understand your point to be drawing on these cases that having said that Ms. Martin's claims are moot, the court had no jurisdiction to address the merits until it found another party before it.
Yep.
Whose claims we know would then under the district court's theory at least be inherently transitory. So it had to have a class or maybe a new name plaintiff or something, but had to have a body before it that had jurisdiction before it had any authority to address the merits.
That's exactly right.
So you're now pursuing an appeal for which you believe there's no jurisdiction.
I wanted to give the court one of two paths. I think the first path, the jurisdictional path, the path that was followed by the 10th and the 2nd, makes the most sense given the sequencing order and the fact that that sequencing order affected the district court's subject matter jurisdiction. If the court doesn't share that concern, then I'm
how did the 10th Circuit Court have jurisdiction, 10th or 2nd have jurisdiction if there was no class yet certified and the named plaintiffs was out on moot?
Because in both those cases, the district court dismissed the class claim just without reaching the class certification issue. And then, as Garrity says, a putative class representative has standing to appeal the denial of class certification, which is exactly what we've done here.
Even when their claim is moot?
Yes, even when their claim is moot.
No, the whole point is that there's nothing for us to decide other than...
Not Linda Martin as an individual plaintiff, Your Honor, but Linda Martin as a class representative. And what the Supreme Court made clear in Garrity is that even if you are dismissed and your individual claims are moot, but you want to serve your position as a class representative, you have the jurisdiction, you have authority to appeal that class cert denial. And that's exactly what we did here. And that's what happened.
That's what you're arguing now in your 28J letter. That's what your 28J letter is advocating here.
Well, we've always, ever since the change in the federal rules of appellate procedure, any appeal of a judgment also appeals all the collateral or all the orders that are subsumed within it. So we...
You are absolutely correct about that. My question is, we then expect the appellant to decide which issues are raised to us.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you have more questions? Ms. Rogers, do you have more questions? We'll give you a couple minutes on rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Josh Koppel for the FBI. I'd like to start with a jurisdictional issue that you were just discussing with opposing counsel. I just want to take a step back and explain exactly the point here. So in an ordinary case where the class representative or the proposed class representative's claim is not moot, the district court has discretion to decide first a motion to dismiss or first a motion to certify a class action. But where the named plaintiff's claim is moot, at that point, there is no plaintiff before the court with standing to present the merits of the claim. And so in that case, the district court can't consider the motion to dismiss. It first has to consider the motion whether to certify a class. If it grants class certification, then now you've got a class of people who can present the claim on the merits, and then the district court can consider the merits.
The district court, though, here effectively said, although Ms. Martin's claim is moot, you know, it fits within the inherently transitory exception. And so her claim effectively relates back. And so, you know, the class claim is live as if her individual claim was not moot. And then why would the district court not have the same option to either rule on the class certification motion or, you know, the 12B6?
So,
because that's the ordinary course. So, you know, we're sort of skip. Yes. I mean, if he hadn't said that there was an exception to mootness, I think it's right that we would have. But he said there was an exception and then he proceeded to do what he did.
So I do want to get back to the inherently transitory exception later because.
That is correct, that the inherently transitory, exception does apply. Why could the district court not choose to do what he thought was more efficient and dismiss on the merits?
So the inherently transitory exception, like any other exception to mootness that could possibly apply, doesn't make the named plaintiff's claim still live, nor does it join before the court all of the proposed class. It just allows the district court to continue to consider the motion for class certification. If it grants that, then the class, not the plaintiff, because her claim is clearly moot, but the class of people with live claims, it's like the class certification relates back to the time of the filing of the complaint. So the Supreme Court addressed this in Garrity, it addressed it in Roper, and it said that where an exception to mootness applies, that only allows the district court to go ahead to consider the motion for class certification. It doesn't allow the court to go ahead to address the merits. The court applied this in Alvarez v. Smith. In that case, the named plaintiff's claim had become moot. The plaintiffs had not appealed the denial of class certification, so the Supreme Court said it didn't have anything before it that it could rule on. Here, it is correct that the denial of class certification merged into the final judgment here, but plaintiffs haven't challenged the denial of class certification in their brief, in their opening brief, not even in their reply brief. They kind of hinted at it as a possibility in their 28J letter. Here at oral argument today was the first time that I really heard them agree that the district court lacked jurisdiction to do what it did. And so now they're arguing for the case to be sent back, for this procedural, you know, morass to be sorted out. But they can't advance that argument, advance that remedy at the for the first time at oral argument. I'm happy to address additional questions on that issue if you have. Otherwise, I do want to make sure we get to the inherently transitory exception.
So when you're, if we were to agree that the district court decided this in the wrong order, what is the remedy? To send it back for the district court to consider the class certification?
I think that because plaintiffs did not ask for that in their opening brief, they didn't point out this error, even in their reply brief after we had identified it. I think that they forfeited that remedy. I think that this court should dismiss for lack of appellate jurisdiction.
Mr. Hovell, I mean, I think the government's briefing on the mootness question is a little bit misleading because the plaintiffs prevailed on the question of the class certification being moot. I mean, that was a decision in their favor, right? Because it was based on the inherently transitory exception to mootness.
Well, the denial of class certification as moot was a decision against them. The decision that there was an exception to mootness applied so that their claim could continue, that was a decision in their favor.
It was, and they were saying that they're not challenging that, right? Because it was a decision in their favor.
The application of an exception to mootness, but that is different than the denial of class certification is moot. I mean, there's two kinds of mootness here, right? There's the mootness of the claim, a plaintiff's claim because her property was returned to her. The district court found an exception to mootness to allow the class claims to go forward. That was a ruling in their favor. Separately, then the district court considered the motion to dismiss without jurisdiction, but it did consider that motion to dismiss, granted it, and then denied the motion for class certification as moot. That was a ruling against the plaintiffs because it was a denial of their motion for class certification. I think that, again, plaintiffs here have forfeited what they now seek as the remedy, which is to send it back to the district court to do things in the reverse order. I think that if they had preserved that argument, that potentially could be done. I think that Judge Ryer's question earlier is correct that it would seemingly be, we'd be back here in a year arguing the merits of this. But there is a jurisdictional problem here. We have an obligation to point out an error, a deficit of jurisdiction before the court. And
a jurisdictional deficit if the inherently transitory determination was correct?
Yes.
Why is that?
Because
the government doesn't really explain that.
Because the district court, even if the inherently transitory exception applied, the district court still did not have jurisdiction to consider the motion to dismiss. It first had to consider the motion for class certification. If that was granted, then the class of individuals with similar claims would be before the court. And now there would be a live controversy on the merits presented to the district court.
Is there any case setting out that rule?
So Garrity says it, Roper says it, and then
quite in this posture, though. I mean, in this sort of, something that is more like squarely like this.
So the Supreme Court in U.S. Parole Commissioner versus Garrity. So in that case, the named plaintiff's claim had become moot after the denial of class certification. And the Supreme Court there said a named plaintiff whose claim expires may not continue to press the appeal on the merits until a class has been properly certified.
There was no determination by the district court of the merits of the class certification, right? So in Garrity, there was a denial of the class certification, like on the merits of whether a class could be certified. Here, the district court didn't make a decision like that.
So I think this case
instead it went to 12b-6.
I think this case is the same as Alvarez v. Smith. There, the named plaintiff's claim in Alvarez became moot before the denial of class certification. The named plaintiff's claim became moot. The district court granted a motion to dismiss and denied class. I'm sorry. The named plaintiff's claim was live. The district court granted a motion to dismiss and denied class certification as moot. While the claim while the case was before the Supreme Court, the named plaintiff's claim became moot. And the Supreme Court said at this point, because the named plaintiff's claim is moot and no class has been certified, we cannot address the merits. We have to, we lack jurisdiction. In that case, the court vacated the decision below under Munsingware, but you know that part of the opinion is independent. So I think that Olivares v. Smith is essentially this case. I think it controls. Even if this, with the court's permission, I would like to address the inherently transitory.
Sorry, Judge Rogers, did you have a question?
I just wanted to be clear. Some of these cases, it seems to me, turned on timing in the terms of when the district court was addressing the individual claim. So we don't have quite the sequence that we have here, where the district court had ruled on it.
I think that the sequence,
you know, some of those cases we're talking about picking off. All right. So the court was trying to avoid that situation. So now we have this inherently. Well, all right. I'll let you finish your point, but
yeah, the situation is not exactly the same in terms of the sequence, but I think that the Supreme Court's rule is clear that unless there is a plaintiff before the court, either the named plaintiff with a live claim or the rest of the class, once it's been certified, and until the class has been certified, they're not before the court. So unless there's the named plaintiff with a live claim or the rest of the class with live claims before the court, the district court doesn't have jurisdiction to address the merits.
It does seem, though, then as a remedy, at a minimum, we need to remand to the district court to class certify, because there was, I mean, at least on your view, there was a mistake in going to the merits.
If the plaintiff,
so, I mean, then that decision, if we don't remand for that consideration, then its ruling below essentially becomes unreviewable.
I think if the plaintiffs had appealed the denial of class certification as moot, if they had said the district court should not have denied our motion for class certification as moot because it shouldn't have addressed the merits in the first place, it should have first considered our motion for class certification, granted it, and then addressed the merits, I think that you would be correct that the court would reverse the dismissal and remand to the district court to consider the motion for class certification. But plaintiffs forfeited or waived that argument by not raising it in their opening brief and not even in their reply brief.
But don't we, to Judge Rao's point, don't we still need to vacate, even if we dismiss the appeal, don't we also need to vacate the district court's decision because it is now come to, I think, everyone's attention that that also was entered without jurisdiction.
I think this court could vacate the district court's decision as well, because, yes, it was entered without jurisdiction.
So here, the notice was dated June 10. And then the FBI answered, and then the plaintiff filed a motion for class certification. And it wasn't, that was in April of 2023. And then she received the money by electronic transfer, I see it, on July 10.
That's right.
So at that point, your argument was, well, her claim is certainly moot. And the district court, in saying that the class action wasn't moot, still had to just procedurally establish its jurisdiction by saying there was a Rule 23 class action here.
That's exactly right. The district court first had to certify a class in order to have any live claims before it that it could consider on the merits.
And so there's no way the court could sort of jump to the merits.
That's correct.
It's not quite a steel company argument, but it's close to that.
I'm sorry?
Well, I was just trying to understand, you know, before steel company courts all the time, assuming we had jurisdiction, you know, you lose on the merits. So I'm just going to dismiss the whole case.
Yes, that's exactly right. Under steel company, the court first had to assure itself of jurisdiction, or in this case, create jurisdiction, basically, by certifying a class before it could rule on the merits. There's no doubt that there was no jurisdiction here.
Well, I wasn't quite clear from the record in this case where there are all these declarations by other people, whether any of that was before the district court.
The motion to certify a class was before a district court, but those individuals were not plaintiffs, were not joined to the case.
Right.
I see I'm out of time. I'm happy to discuss the other issues, including why the court erred in finding the inherently transitory exception applied. But
Rogers, do you have more questions? Let me just see if there's...
No, thank you.
I do have a lot of questions about the merits, but it seems that even your colleague on the other side has suggested we no longer have jurisdiction to consider that. So,
thank you
very much, counsel. Hey, Mr. Frommer, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Just a couple of small points, Your Honor. I understand that my opposing counsel is saying that we're on all fours with Alvarez, and I'd say that respectfully, we're not. For the fundamental reason I mentioned before is that in Alvarez, the plaintiff's counsel had failed to appeal the class cert denial, and the case went up, and that's what the issue was in that case and why the court lacked jurisdiction. Here, we did appeal the class cert denial. It was subsumed, and that's basically what I was talking about before.
The appeal in Alvarez didn't work the same way your notice of appeal works?
That's exactly right, Your Honor, because the rules of appellate procedure changed between Alvarez and now, so as to, as I think I put it in the brief, remove that trap for the unwary by subsuming all the orders into the judgment being appealed.
In our case in Lewis versus Becerra, so even if we assume that your brief was arguing that Ms. Martin was here in her representative capacity for the class, we held that you have to demonstrate that Ms. Martin here has an injury from denial of the class certification, not of her own claims, but from denial of the class certification, and established that she has appellate standing to bring this issue before us. Where have you done that in your briefing?
Well, we articulated why she, the process that she went through, that she engaged in this litigation precisely to vindicate not only her own rights, but the rights of the class. But I understand you're talking about the personal stake requirement.
Personal stake in the, not in the forfeiture issue, but in the class certification issue.
And in that issue, it's more than just a, I believe in that case, we said that it's more than just simply a desire, a bare desire to serve as class representative. This was a...
To vindicate the law.
Yeah, to merely... Well, and I believe in Lewis versus Becerra, they actually said, like, we just want to have the opportunity to serve as class representatives, which this court said was not enough. I agree that there is...
But we all know that under Article 3, a desire to see the law vindicated for other people, generically, is not sufficient.
Exactly.
And so, have you argued here that she does have interest in class certification, an injury from the denial of class certification distinct from her, obviously, the injury she had before her claim got paid?
Well, I will concede that most of our briefing focused on the merits. I would say here that we didn't specifically argue the personal stake because, again, following the district court's lead, we were focused in on the 12B6 issues, the merits issues. And so I think if we're able to go back down and get, if we'd be able to brief that properly. And I would just lastly, and I let the court, both the 10th Circuit in the Medina case, it hit this exact same point where it realized, oh, we don't have jurisdiction. And then it immediately went, well, that means the district court didn't have jurisdiction either. And that's why it vacated and remanded. And it said there wasn't any forfeiture because it went to its subject matter jurisdiction. Similarly, in the Second Circuit case, There was that court also said there was no forfeiture because there was no surprise to the government. And most importantly,
the surprise to the government here.
I think the government in its appellee brief noted the jurisdictional issue. So it doesn't seem that there was a surprise to it.
Didn't get a chance to brief all these cases that you've now cited to us.
I understand that, Your Honor, but I'd say.
Any further questions? I'll let you finish your sentence.
Okay, I was just going to say the Second Circuit said there was no forfeiture precisely because the district court rested its class certification decision on the merits of the plaintiff's claims. And that's why it said forfeiture should be excused there.
Okay. Thank you very much. The case is submitted.